This is the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad Network.
Hello, and welcome to Bodies of Horror, the podcast where we look at all of our favorite horror films from the classic, the camp, to the cringe, through the lens of disability. My name is Nicole. I'm your host, and as always, I'm thrilled to have you here. So, what is on the examination table for this episode? Well, you are in luck because I'm not alone, and you know what that means. Whenever I have someone with me here at the examination table, they gotta tell you what's what. So, who is here with me? I'm so excited to have Sheree Bohannon with me for this episode. She is a co-host on Nightmare on Fear Street, Bloody Massacre. Oh, and of course, she's a member of the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad. She has covered series, well, lots of different series. I think you've covered From and You, as well as done some episodes of The Alter Tapes. So, heard her voice. So excited to have you here, Sheree. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. I am also very excited for this movie because we put our heads together, came up with a Jasmine Savoy Brown movie, and it is definitely her era. We are all living in, and we are welcome. And I feel like this is one of the movies on her resume that goes under the radars of so many people, and I don't know why, because it's so cool, and it's some of her early work, and you get to see how great she was before we knew her in, like, Yellow Jackets and Scream. We are here with Sound of Violence.
Yes! Sound of Violence! 2021, I think, was the official release year of Sound of Violence. So actually, like, right at kind of her come up, because right then and there, she morphed before us into kind of the fierce presence on Yellow Jackets. Oh, and what's that? Mindy Meeks Martin, core four? Absolutely. From Scream. Love it. So, yes, Jasmine Savoy Brown. And this is directed by Alex Noyer, who this is based off of his short, Conductor. And it's really interesting. I listened to an interview between him and a former guest on the pod, Ariel Baska from Ghouls Magazine. She talked to him a little bit, and he really talks a lot about just, you know, really looking at this as an artist, because this is a piece about art. And this man is French and Finnish, and so art. So it was really, really cool. And he also talked about how he had made this film and had spent a lot of time, like, diving into drum machines to a point that he became so immersed and enmeshed with this that he's like, I really, really want to murder someone with this drum machine because I just absolutely am obsessed. And he's like, and thus the Conductor. And that's, like, amazing. Phenomenal. Yeah. Couldn't ask for better. So, yes, this is the film that we're talking about. So, lots to unpack here. So, as we do around these parts, let's begin this by giving ourselves a little plot synopsis from Friend of the Pod, Wikipedia. And here we go. Alexis, who has recovered her hearing after witnessing the brutal murder of her family at the age of 10, has synesthesia abilities, or synesthetic abilities, awakened in her and starts a journey of self-discovery through the healing music of brutal violence in pursuit of a career through experimenting, new sounds, Alex enlists the help of her loving roommate, Marie, who is unaware of the dark purpose behind Alexis's actions and the part she is unknowingly playing. Faced with the likelihood of losing her hearing again, Alexis begins a rampage to create her masterpiece, not letting anything, not even love, get in her way. So this is a short, sweet, and concise plot synopsis from
Yes.
Wikipedia, a delightful change of pace, that without giving every little movement and breakdown. So, Cherie, when we were going back and forth, and you were so gracious to say I would love to be on the pod, let's talk about a film to cover. We had a very small list of films that we went back and forth on, and you very enthusiastically were like, I like this one. So, gotta know, what about this film and seeing that list was like, this is the gem. And tell me a little bit about your first experience with this film.
Yay. So the first thing that pulls me towards this film is I'm always asking for more intersectionality. I feel like lots of times filmmakers are like, I'm doing the one thing and they just default. And so you don't normally get to see like a Black woman who is also someone with like a hearing impairment. Even though people exist. Some of my friends fit this bill. I also love that we have a Black woman who is she's not 100% the villain, but she's not a victim. She's definitely doing the work. She is doing the harming. And we don't typically get that because usually we're disposed of within the first 5 minutes of the movie. And so I'm always looking for Black girl rage. I'm always looking for justifiable angry Black women because that is one of the things that society tells us is a bad thing to be. A lot of us should be angry. A lot of people in general should be angry. The world is the world it is. And I don't know why Black women get told that being an angry Black woman is such a bad thing. I think that it's what gets me out of bed in the mornings. It's what makes me do my things. I'm always telling people spite is a real great motivator for me. I usually do things because someone told me I couldn't do it, or there's no room for me to do it, and that's why I have too many podcasts. own your anger. And so I love that. And I also love that, weirdly enough, we're getting it from a guy, because typically when men make movies, you're just like, a man's been here. And I don't know too much about Alex. Like we've had a couple conversations on Twitter and Clubhouse, but like I don't I've never gotten the I'm gonna make a skeevy movie because it, and so I went into this one being like, Jasmine Soy Brown is here. She seems to be doing things. What's happening? Did you give me a complex woman character that I can't 100% support, but also I'm supporting. How dare you? Thank you, good sir. I watched it the first time after one of the conversations in Clubhouse because I was talking about how people were saying, as they often do in the industry, why does your lead need to be Black? It's more marketable if the lead's not Black. And I get that a lot because I write Black characters. I'm a playwright and I'm an aspiring screenwriter. Most of my characters are Black women because I'm writing from what I know and I'm writing what I want to see because we are woefully underrepresented. And so we sort of bonded over that conversation and I was like, I'm going to see your movie. And then I found out it was Jasmine Savoy Brown. I'm like, they didn't want you to cast Jasmine Savoy Brown? Are you serious? If they don't want her, who do they want? Because, like, again, this is her era. So I watched it once, the first time, and I was like, I just had a journey. It's a lot to unpack. I gotta watch it again. And so I made us watch it again in a Clubhouse room, and Alex was so gracious to join us and our friends and fans and sort of explain some things to us and like hang out with people for a minute. And it was cool hearing some of the like behind the scenes stuff and how things came to be, and him reiterating that story of how they were like, why should it have to be Black? And he's like, why can't she be Black? Like
I love that, and that very much really hits on what he talked about in his interview. I'm so glad that you stated it so perfectly because he mentioned just that. He's like, I was getting pushback about like why does this character have to be X, Y, or Z? Because she's also not straight.
So
And
many,
so
there's so many intersections, and that's another reason why I love her, and she's one of my favorite characters. Because again, the industry is, and I don't know if it's execs pushing filmmakers or filmmakers just can't, but we usually get the one and done. And so, like, for instance, if they're like, I'm going to do a deaf person, she's a white woman, and then they accidentally put on all the other tropes because the people around her are usually like smaller characters or people of color and dying. Or they're like, well, this person's going to be queer. So of course they can't have a disability or be a brown person. And I'm just like, again, I need to get out in the world because the people I know, the people I'm talking to and I'm seeing are so many different things. Like identity is not just, that's my thing. Thanks. We often get many things to be and many things to represent. And I don't know why people can't wrap their brains around that.
yeah, no, exactly. And that's something that, especially like in having a disability-centric podcast, I really wanted to explore that intersectionality because it is really important to just overall experience. The disability experience is not a monolith. And so to be able to have individuals that are coming from different perspectives than I am, like I'm white, I'm not straight, but like that. I want different perspectives because that helps the conversation. It's an important piece of the conversation. And Alex very much was like, this was something that was very important to me in writing this character, was that you had someone that was so interestingly developed and complex that you never really knew how to react to what she was doing and what she was doing. Just like, and how she was doing it, because it's like, well, what is her motivation? Why is she doing these things? And it's kind of beautiful the way that it's being done, but it's also very troubling. And so I've watched it a couple of times. It just popped up and I thought, oh, well, this looks very interesting. It deals with disability. Let me take a gander. And I love Jasmine. I think she's great. So I was very excited and was like, what the fuck did I just watch? Like, I don't, well, I'm like, I'm just gonna take a nap for 8 hours and think about this because I just don't know. And then I'm like, well, I woke up and I'm like, maybe I need another 8 hours because I still am perplexed about like what we're doing here. But I love it. I think it's very interesting, and the questions that you're kind of left with are very fascinating and good. So, in terms of like reception, this is a very small film. I never want to be that person that's like, we're not talking enough about blah, blah, blah. Because I don't feel like I'm the person to ever say that.
Now.
But I'm not talking about this movie because I think it's very interesting.
It does so much cool stuff. And again, we're talking about Justice Roy Brown's character, Alexis, who has all of his intersections, and also her character is giving a character arc that normally goes to cis straight white men, which also makes it more interesting. And it also makes that like romance towards, because they always have the Southern Gothic romance and your Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and your Frankenstein and all those. And so to have her be like, it's that girl. And I was like, oh, we're gonna get all of it in this movie. Thank you, Alex. I love that because again, I like seeing anybody who's underrepresented in spaces that are typically going to Tom Cruise. those spaces. Yeah.
Yes. A job taken away from Tom Cruise is a job we support.
Listen.
Like, hot take. Follow me about my cold feelings later. But No, I agree. Like, I do think that's really, interesting. So I want to dig into just the what the fuck tiramisu of this film. And we start with our first layer, which is the opening, which, in the interview with, Ariel, who is someone that is hard of hearing, talks about how the opening of the film is very grounded, aka it's very realistic. So Alexis as a child is deaf. We don't get any context. Now I do want to lay this out from the tip top. We never get any context about what her condition was as a child. If it was something that was an accident that impacted her hearing, a progressive illness.
They mentioned accident one time, and I only know that because I've seen this movie like six times now, but they mentioned it once outside with the car and before, like, what kind of accident? Oh, yeah.
Exactly. And sometimes those accidents aren't necessarily what caused the issue, but help a doctor or healthcare practitioner unravel what is an underlying illness, condition, whatever. I say this, one, I think I've mentioned this on other episodes, but my dad is deaf. He has essentially been hard of hearing since I think I was conceived. He had an accident, and it impacted his eardrum. He never got it looked at, fixed, anything, and his hearing has just been substantially downhill, ever since. And it was finally my stepmonster that got him to, enter the fascinating and beautiful world of hearing aids, which he
Yes.
still refuses to wear. So anytime that I actually reach out to him, like once in a decade, it is a conversation of what? Huh? Huh?
Why are parents this way?
And so I finally broke down and said, look, I don't want to say I want to talk to you, but as your, I guess, genetic product, I feel so inclined, thank you to societal pressures. So, how about we video chat and I know a little bit of sign language and I can teach you, and this will help make conversations a little bit easier for both of us. And he was very hesitant to that because he's like, I'm not hard of hearing. I'm like, Dad, you have hearing aids that you don't wear. You constantly cannot hear anything I'm saying. So I don't know what to tell you. So it's just been a struggle. But finally, I think he's on whatever journey he's on. And I hope it leads to ASL and being able to kind of embrace other forms of communication. We do have the family signing at the beginning. We also have communication, vocal communication, because Alex in the interview points out that yes, this would have been her like initial and primary communication. So she's gonna vocalize. Because that's always something that's really interesting that people will react to when there's a deaf or hard of hearing character, who speaks. They're like, deaf or hard of hearing people can speak. Actually, yes, they can, and get familiar.
The amount of people on Twitter who are always like, why is she speaking if she's deaf? Or why is she standing up if she's in a wheelchair? And I don't understand how we get to 2024 and people don't understand that there are different versions of different disabilities. And so what they're doing is they're just like all or nothing, as opposed to some people are hard of hearing, as opposed to being completely deaf. And also that doesn't affect your vocal cords unless there's a different situation going on. And so like I don't understand why people just don't get to the Google. The Google is right there. You don't have to go to Twitter and say something ridiculous and everybody judge you. You could be like, I didn't know this. Let me go Google.
Yeah, and I think that it's also a very limited perspective in terms of look at how we as a society treat people who do not communicate or interact in the world in a way that we find convenient, acceptable, quote unquote, normal. If someone came to you and could not vocalize, how are you going to communicate with them? The coffee shop that I go to is deaf and hard of hearing operated and owned. And so it was a great way for me to brush up on my ASL so that I love my coffee. So, hey, I can go and have a conversation with the barista, and it's been really great. But they also can talk. But they're very clear to say, like, not on the clock, here's your signs, point to what you want, blah, blah, blah. It's actually like, yes, as I am always saying, disability is not a monolith, and everything is unique. And, I talked about like the wheelchair thing in my last episode talking about Run, because there was some casting controversy around that, and I had many thoughts and feelings about that. So I love that Alex was very thoughtful and was like, I wanted to make sure that in a character, like, I tried to do my research, I tried to be mindful and thoughtful about how I was presenting, especially in these early scenes, kind of relatable but lived in experience for this character. So I like that. And then quickly, very quickly, things get turned on. I want to use the saying things get turned on its ear, but it feels inappropriate. Things get turned upside down because what we find about Alexis is that she's very drawn to music. And so even though she's maybe it's something that from a very, very young age, maybe perhaps her hearing was impacted, she loved music. And so there is a moment where we see in the car where she's with her mom. It's a really beautiful scene. She's filming the speaker on the side of the car. And this is something that lots of folks experience. My one of my best friends was dating someone who was deaf, and they went out to a bar just to meet up with friends. And someone said something like, well, at least, they don't have to deal with the music in the club. And Bill was like, my friend Bill was who he was dating, said, well, actually, that's not really accurate. Like, they can feel the rhythm and the beat, and they love music and dance and do all the things with music that we do, and it's great. And so I love that we get that experience, right from the jump. And then she goes off to her room to she wants to make music. And all right, what do you got?
I was just gonna say, I also love that we see her having the vibrations and like listening to music in the way that she can. Because again, so often in the media, when somebody does have a disability, they come across as helpless because people who don't understand are writing them. And that's one of my frustrations with a lot of the things we've seen. Like, I'm not gonna sit here and complain about Hush for the entire time because we're doing a different movie. But when I watched that movie, I got so mad. I got so mad.
Thank you. I hate that movie so much.
Oh, that's Weird
No one
Twins.
understands me.
It made me so mad because again, I am not in the deaf community. I just happen to have known some people, and I sometimes Google before I think to say something out loud. And so I was like, no, she would feel the vibration. She would know that that man is behind her. She would. What are we doing? What? Why are we doing this way? I was very mad when we covered that on my podcast, and I pulled like a YouTuber who is deaf, and she was also mad. So I had somebody, because it wasn't just me being like, well, this is what I think and I remember. It was like, no, I have an authority on the situation. I'm going to quote her. Also, go follow her. She too is wrong with me. And I hate that. And it keeps happening. And it's part of that whole I don't understand because I don't want to understand. And I just think that everybody who's not in my identity can't do anything. And so why bother? Which again is why we keep seeing these people on Twitter who are just like, that's not how that goes. And people are like, hi, I'm living in a body that experiences that. I'm telling you from my perspective, that's how that goes. And they're just like, no. I hate people. Like that's end of rant. I'm sorry.
And it's so right. And again, I think this is a difference, and I'm glad that you brought up Hush, not just because now, like, if I didn't, Shri, if I didn't love you before, now we have a shared hatred of Hush, and
Yes.
this is good energy. Like, here's the thing, Mike Flanagan, I think you're great. I think you're fine. I think you're a lovely person. I think you made poor choices,
Yes.
and that's okay. I make poor choices every day,
Every day.
and that's fine. But I think that to exactly what you're saying, it's just Alex really seemed to say, I want something that seems authentic and lived in. Maybe it's not the cookie cutter stereotypical depiction of what X, Y, or Z will look like, but I want it to be from an authentic place. So I'm gonna try to do some research. I'm gonna try to be mindful about how I integrate this piece into the story. And I think that's part and parcel, maybe why we do get so few details about like the logistics of everything, which is fine. That's a way to operate.
I kind of like not knowing all the details because in the real world, I wouldn't walk up to somebody and be like, how'd you get this way? That feels wrong. And so we don't always know because people, it's their option to share and not share. Like I know I don't walk up to people and go, here's all my trauma. Here's everything that's ever happened to me. How are you? Good Monday. And so why would somebody be like, well, when I was five, what happened was. And I appreciate that. I also appreciate that we know that at some point she lost her hearing. And that's been the family coming together to like learn the ASL. It's been all of the things. And I'll tell your sister to look at me. You know, it feels lived in, which I also appreciate because sometimes
Yes.
filmmakers think they're doing a thing and it's really just like, oh, I added this at the last minute. And so again, I don't know if Alexis is based on somebody Alex knows, or what, but she feels like there was some care given to her, at least for me on the outside again.
No, I agree, and I don't think that he was based off of someone that he knew specifically. But he did mention that when I think the script had made it over to Jasmine, she was 100% like, this is fantastic. I really love this character. I really am so intrigued by all the bits and pieces. And so you really do start your building blocks here at the beginning. But we haven't even got to like the what I call the jump off. And
Yes.
so, and what I love about this film is that if you look up so many of the plot synopsis or summaries of what this film is, there could be some outliers. Guys, I try to do my research, but I only have so many hours in a day. You may uncover something that I did not. But They're always very vague in terms of she sees her family murdered. She experiences this, but they don't get into the detail. The detail is this. We learn that her dad is a veteran, and is experiencing PTSD, to a high degree, and that she and her mother have a very brief back and forth about this early on. And then when they get home, you can see that the dad is kind of in a state as they're having dinner. And then she goes upstairs and she starts to experience like some vibrations, some whatever. And she goes downstairs and dad is killing the fam. Not just in a simple one-shot murder. We are talking ultimate brutality. And she has this reaction, and I cannot describe it. It's almost like this is a moment because she has this moment when she's at the dinner table where she's like, Dad, I can't hear you. And I think it's also speaking to a barrier that she's having with her dad of connecting with him. She has this great connection with her mom. But because I think both her and her dad are having kind of these conflicting struggles, they're not able to have this connection. There's something connecting about how she's reacting to what's happening in front of her, what it's inciting kind of in her with this sensation of seeing lots of color, and just kind of like this surreal experience. She ends up killing her father, and as we slightly later learn to understand, she is in shifted into foster care for her youth, and this comes back later. She, like I mentioned, when we rejoin kind of the main story, she's much older. She's an adult. She's a burgeoning artist, still with that love of music and really experimenting with sounds and kind of like one of those DJs that you would see in the early 2000s in kind of a up and coming hipster party slash rave of some kind. I don't know. I grew up in Iowa. I don't know these things. This is what I imagine. But she's very experimental and she has a roommate that is like, go with the flow and is like, let's do this. We get a progression of violence following this. I've mentioned before, I'm part of the BDSM community here in DC, part of the kink scene. And our first entry point is that we do realize that Alexis has never shied away from, like, I really like the interplay of, like, painful sounds in my music. And so she and her roommate go off to see this dominatrix and her sub in a scene, and she wants to record the sounds of him being punished. And we realize that something is not exactly as it should be, because Alexis begins to ask the dominatrix to push beyond comfort levels, both her own and the submissives in the dynamic here, which is 100%, if anyone is worth their kind of worth their ethical standing as someone who is a dominant, that's when you shut the situation down. You're like, no, you're out. You're not going to be pushing anyone past the comfort level of where they are. That's not what this is about. And I will see you never again. Thank you so much for coming, and I bid you good day. But finally, the Dom like shuts it down and says, "No more. You got what you need." And we learn that then, Alexis can experience synesthesia. She sees colors, and in the interview that I mentioned with Alex, he mentions the Northern Lights being a huge inspiration for him with this, which I found really beautiful and striking. So, something that plays in really well. But so we see how she intercuts this into music. She goes to the club. She's playing some tracks. You get little snippets of this kind of interlaced in. And then we start to see things slowly progress because it's not necessarily itching the scratch, the artistic scratch that she has. So how did you feel about the way that things that we start to see some of these encounters ramp up?
I like the pacing of it because, again, like we get the glimpses, like when she's talking to the dominatrix, and like we understand something's happening every time she does something until she's getting bolder and bolder, and all of a sudden bodies are piling up. But we also don't go immediately to like hurting innocent people, so you're not too mad at her. Because like, I mean, we all encounter assholes. I don't know if we should all be killing them. Sometimes I'm not so sure. But like the asshole from the record store, we were like, you know what? We're not gonna miss him. It's fine. I'll allow this one. And then she's like, but also this like random person out here who's just trying to make a living as an artist in an art gallery. I'm like, girl, you've gone too far. And I love the progression because again, we see her sort of descent into what her madness would look like for this film, which is something that again, we don't normally get when we're talking about anybody with any identities, like queer woman
Right.
losing her hearing, black woman. None of those identities ever get to have a descent into madness, especially one that's like earned and justified. It's usually just like, we're gonna do ma. And it's like, okay, thanks, Blumhouse. And so I love that we get some time with her. We get to like root for her. We get to like wonder if we should be rooting for her. I think it's beautifully paced. I think that again, every time she steps over another boundary, I can't help but lean in, even though again I've seen this movie like six times. I'm just like, oh, that's another boundary. Oh, that's another boundary. You're not coming back from this one.
That's so interesting. And one of the things that popped into my mind, and I would love to hear your thoughts on this. So, thinking about the trope of the disabled villain, especially as we think about like the disabled villain as kind of like your kind of old school disfigured kind of individual that's like Phantom of the Opera, Hunchback of Notre Dame. Things of that nature where it was like, I want you to pay, because society doesn't understand me, or I want to seek revenge for what was done to me. This isn't necessarily the case. I what I find really interesting is that I found myself thinking, like, she's crossing these boundaries. Wanting to create this kind of art to explain to people what she experiences because she doesn't really know how else to do it because there's not really another way to communicate that. You can't say, "Hey, I saw my dad killing my family, and this is, hearing the fact of, the whole fact of this against my mother's head really made me see the color blue. And this is what I want to serve while you're getting your watered down vodka tonic at a club at 1 a.m." Like, I think that this is her way, like incorporating this bit is for her to kind of stay connected, but also disconnect from reality. Because when she's having these experiences, she's not in this world.
It's a sense of euphoria.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is also interesting because, again, all of the identities doing something for themselves. Because so often we are the "Are you okay, girl?" We are there to serve and then like die 5 minutes later. And so for her to be like, "This brings me some joy. Also, this is my art, and I'm gonna stand by it." And it also is like another parallel to her father because he's come back from war and he seems to be the type of man who can't share and maybe isn't getting therapy. I get the sense he's not getting help. Because of the
Yeah.
way the mom is speaking to him, where she's just sort of babying him as I hate that dynamic. I do. But it's so realistic to where I'm just like, I've seen these couples. I've listened to these couples because it's just like, he's not
Yeah.
okay. You're not challenging him to be okay. You're not going, "Hey, get help." You're not saying, "Hey, have you tried this? Talk to a doctor, perhaps." So we're just all walking on eggshells and that's how we're going to live. And that does not end well for anybody. But clearly he's going through something and he can't or he won't share it. And she also can't or won't share it. And she knows that even when she's a kid because they're like, "Are you okay?" And she's smiling like she's covered in her dad's blood, which I love that image.
Yeah.
And again, she's not like, "Hey, this is what's happening. Can we do something about it?" Or like, "Can I get somebody to like look at this?" It's like, "This is my secret. This is my inner world and you're all locked out." Which might be another reason why we're so drawn to her, because it's just like, just let us in. Let us see if we can help you, which we probably can't. But still, I think that's part of it, as opposed to her being like, "Here's my manifesto. Here's why I did everything I've ever done." She's just like, "You got what you got. Either you get me or you don't."
Yeah. No, I think that's perfectly stated. And we see kind of this journey. And again, in that interview, Alex references a lot of Giallo influences, which you get so much.
Somebody. I always wanted to ask him that because I started getting a giallo around the time the pandemic started because I mean we've all seen a couple but we didn't know what it was, we were children. And so now that I'm like, these are kind of benchmark, this is kind of a style, this is kind of an aesthetic. I've always wanted to be like, was that part of your research, was that part of your book, what was going on? Because it feels very Argento, it feels very much the stuff I get into on Shudder on a Saturday.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, he definitely talked about that, especially the gallery scene.
Yes. Yes.
Which again, as we're talking about ramp up, so we start out with what I think she's obviously crossing boundaries and not doing great, with our first kind of tidbit here of how she's creating this music. And then after that, she's like, you know what? No more encounters with this in which I don't leave a dead body. Like, this is really where my heart lies. Is like, in order for my music to be successful, someone must, like, I must leave a corpse. And that's okay. And so she finds this man, that's in an alley, someone who's unhoused and has obviously, I think also based on their very brief back and forth, has probably been harassing some folks, that have come through. And so again, this kind of weird, like, are we trying to justify this interaction, but she's like, hey, let me help you. It reminds me very much of Patrick Bateman in American Psycho with the, let me have a conversation with you. How are you doing? How can I help you? Let me give you money. So she's like, why don't you come with me? And then she ends up basically like strapping him to this machine that she's created. to that's hooked up to her basically like soundboard, her mixer, and as she's like putting together music, in the background he's being bludgeoned to death by basically like meat tenderizer mallets. And it's recording the sound and kind of adding in this layer, and obviously he dies. There's this very, if there's one thing that I have to kind of critique this film about, there's also like the cops that are like following the trail of dead bodies, but they don't really seem to do anything. They're just like, wow, that guy's head exploded. Sucks. Anyway, that paperwork on my desk gotta get done.
I kind of like that because usually the cops are worthless. But again, I'm coming at it from my own lived experiences and they're not trying to help me. And so I'm like, that tracks. And I also kind of love that like the lead detective is a brown woman, which I've been trying to track more often when we're using people of color in police roles and they're getting stuff to do. Because often it's just like, you got two lines. I'm diverse. Yay. And so I love that, like, when they get to do more and I get to, like, actually think about it and chew on things. I think that's interesting. I kind of love that we have a woman of color who's like, no, this person's brilliant and we got to do something. And my squad is not helpful. And so I love that she's the one on the case. She's like, we're going to find this person. We are not going to be useless. We're going to be useful. We're going to change the name of what people expect from us. And I kind of wish that they'd gotten a little bit more cat and mouse, her and Alexis, because again, like we have two POCs sort of driving it from both halves. And I know that they can't like actually sit down and have dinner or a scene or something because this is another kind of a movie. But I just wish that we got a little bit more of her getting in Alexis's head or like snooping around Alexis's stuff before it was like, she did it, let's go get her. Yeah.
Exactly. And she does seem to be the one person that's like, wow, like I'm trying to actually pay attention to the bits and pieces here of what these scenes are telling us and create a picture of someone that we can follow and know. But yeah, her crew is of utmost uselessness. And it kind of makes it heartbreaking at the end. Which we'll get to in just a minute, but it's just I do wonder, like, is there another way that you could have added in some kind of like cat and mouse or actual development between these two characters that would have fit within the world of the film? Because this film is very different. It's very surrealistic, and so you're not, I don't know. There's just a lot of room to play. But I do like that she's kind of picking up on certain things, but it's like, I want more. Give me more with these cops because there is something interesting there. But the cops are kind of on these scenes because Alexis isn't really trying to like hide the bodies.
She has big Batman villain energy in the way that she's going about things because she's like doing all of this stuff and setting up all of this. She's setting up scenes. She's staging moments and like she's making her art while people are dying behind her. And she takes her equipment and she leaves it. And she's like, not my mess. It's very
Yeah.
big Arkham Asylum energy.
I find that very interesting because that's always something within a horror film. It's like, how does a killer that is killing multiple people, a serial killer that's kind of on a spree, how do they progress? And Alexis is like, I'm not, just take, follow me on my journey. Don't worry about that. Like, I'm not gonna stop to clean. I'm not going to stop to do any of that. This is not what this is for. It's about the art. Art is messy. And
Messy.
so is someone exploding their head. So this is where we are. This is what we're doing.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I was gonna say I also love it because so often Anybody with any of her identities is afraid of taking up space because society's mean, people are bullies. And so a lot of us are almost apologizing for existing for a long time, especially around that age, because she's like early 20s. And so for her to just be like, not my mess anymore, they'll figure it out. That's why I leave in such a mood. And again, it's part of why I'm rooting for her, because I'm just like, the cops are doing anything, they might as well clean up after you. Like, I'm not gonna collect this check, do something.
Exactly. Exactly. I love that. So we then have her, like I said, I don't want to say that we amp up because the violence is always there. It's always pretty intense. And this film has some good gore. But we then get, this is honestly like it's one of my favorite scenes because I just love how ridiculous it goes. So there she brings in this guy and he's responded to like a solicitation of like I want to find someone with like this vocal range, a tenor, I think it is. And he's like, yes, I am a tenor. I shall sing you the national fucking anthem. It's just like you certainly will. And so starts out, he's kind of this pompous asshole to her, but not in a really like overtly like a grievous way. He's just like that asshole that annoys you. And so he goes into the booth, he sings his bars, and she's like, hold up. Gotta channel this. I'm gonna put some sensors on you. Just so I can really see like what the music is doing as you're creating it. And he's like, that's cool. And she's like, really belted out. Like I want you to go to fucking like World Series national anthem. You're singing it. Let it go. And we realize then that the sensors are actually like electroshock or kind of like these kinds of sensors that are basically like electronic pulses. They're basically frying him and they zap him and his brain and his head explode as she's like increasing it. And what I think this scene does that I think maybe some of the others don't. That it does give you this prolonged experience more with the music. We really do get to see how this man, because he's like, she's stimulating these sensors for quite some time, it feels. It's really not that long, but in film time, it feels very long. And so we really do get to see, like, how this is playing into the sound and the music. And so it's very interesting for us to kind of say, oh, I kind of understand, like, now what she might be after, what she's looking to kind of harvest from these experiences.
It was very behind the music, and that's why I didn't mind that took a little bit. I also love that scene because she's annoyed with this man. We know she's annoyed with this man because of her interactions in the music store. And so as he's talking and like confirming that he's really the worst person in the world, her face is
Yeah.
just like, I can't wait to kill you. And I think that's part of the reason that's my favorite. On paper, it's my favorite kill because that's the one where she's like, you deserve this. You're gonna get this. And everybody else seems to be like, you might snitch on me, or oh, you were in the right time, in the right place, and you were scary that one time. But this is like personal.
Exactly, and I do like that. I think it's quite good. So I do appreciate I think that piece. So then we get to so cops show up, they're like, wow, this is bad. We really need to get on this, don't we? And So then we start to see breakdown in her relationship with her roommate. She and her roommate are very, very close. There's kind of this vibe between them, like, are they kind of a couple? And we later realized that even if it wasn't explicit at the time that they did have these kind of feelings for each other, but her roommate is seeing someone, it's not very serious, and the guy is kind of whatever, a usual dude, which is kind of her approach. She's like, why are you dating this basic ass man? And the roommate's like, did you know I'm dating a basic ass man? And like, it's fine, like, we're fine, it's not that serious. I don't know why you're upset about it. And so it causes this rift. And also, there's this undercurrent of things that are also going on while she's really ramping up the violence and really kind of getting some gratification from this. She's reconnecting to like that early experience of basically murdering her father. Because that's really what she's after. And she sees these hallucinations of her dad saying how proud he is of her. These are very, I think there's only like more, there's maybe like a couple sprinkled through. But it's very interesting. We see that she's really trying to like go back and connect with this traumatic experience. And her roommate obviously has concern about this. Like, this doesn't seem like a healthy approach of dealing with this experience that happened to you. And so they become slightly distant, but we learn that they are going on, that the roommate and this guy that she's seeing is going on a date night, and they're going to a gallery. And it is every gallery that you could picture in your mind. It is art on a wall. It is a bunch of bougie people walking around, mixed with some hipsters that got tickets. You got this harpist who is playing, and I think this is one of the more aesthetically like stunning moments. What, talk to me about your feelings about this scene.
This is the scene where like she's gone full villain now because we don't know if her and the Harpers have a history. We just know that the roommate and the roommate's sometimes sleepover buddy is here. And I think that's part of the reason Alexis chose this. She's like, I'm gonna ruin date night and also have access to this woman's harp. So two birds, one stone. That's when she gets her I am really the DC comic book villain moment. And
Yes.
I kind of like it, but also I feel like because of the way it goes down, it's just like we have to immediately get to the end of the movie. There's no more room to grow. There's no more room to play with things. Everything happens so quickly after that. And I wish there was a way we could have suspended the tension just a little bit longer afterwards. And that's weird of me to say that because I don't love long movies, notoriously anti-long movie. But I just feel like we could have gotten more juice after that from this moment and these relationships. And I know that Alex, at least a few years ago, was not opposed to a sequel because clearly our girl gets away. And so I wonder if this is like the appetizer to what that would and could be if we ever get that.
No, this is true. And I'm glad that you mentioned the history with the harpist because so this is the rare time where one of these individuals live this encounter. She survives. So what happens, and this is fucking wild, and it hits on everything that I hate, and I'm just like, it makes me like ball up and just go inside myself. I hate hand trauma. Also, Mike Flanagan, you and I need to have a conversation because obviously you and I, you guys are very different people. And I think you're very fascinating. You very much like hand drama. This is for me.
The Jones game to
Don't.
gloving.
Yeah. Woo. Cannot handle it. But here's some hand drama. So we later put the pieces together. This is a harpist. She had taken her harp to the school that Alexis goes to as a student. Because again, she's a student during this time. I think maybe an advanced degree graduate student of some kind, because we also see her providing some instruction here and there. But the harpist says, "Well, I took my harp in to be serviced at this school." This is the only connection that we get. Not to say that there wasn't more, but there isn't like some encounter like with the previous guy where, there was some negative back and forth. It's just someone who took their harp in to be serviced, tuned, and what Alexis has done is basically equipped it with different blades to really do a job on the harpist and their hands as they're playing. And there also seem to be like, in watching this scene, the harpist also seemed to go into kind of like a state.
She drugged her. I don't know with what, though.
Yeah. So it's kind of two things happening. It's I blinged out this harp with some blades, so as she's playing, she's getting brutalized. But I'm also like, I've done something to her cognitively that she can't stop playing. It's very, very brutal. And so her roommate is there and is seeing it, and it's very much out in the open. I have a very, I get very compelled and interested in scenes where we see these types of acts done in public with an audience, because this is a statement. This isn't just about, I want to commit an act of brutality. This is about wanting to say something. And again, this goes back to why I think that maybe one of the motivations that Alexis has with this is that she wants someone, anyone, people to understand what she experiences with these different sounds. So we see blood dripping down the harp. We see it is a very gory encounter, and we see that the roommate is there and is absolutely traumatized by what she's experiencing. They intervene. The harpist is not killed. She is in the hospital, and they talk to her later. And again, this is where we get the little tidbit that all she knows is that she took her harp in to get service at the school. She doesn't know anyone. So, but this is also kind of underscoring, I think, the furthering rift between her and her roommate, because the kind of guy that she's occasional sleepover buddy says, "Hey, I think I saw Alexis here." Because Alexis is kind of keeping a low profile. She's hiding out to kind of keep an eye on what's happening, but stay out of the vision range of attendees. But Duke spots her and is like, "I think I saw her. And isn't that weird?" Isn't that weird? Because they have a weird encounter early on. And so, yeah, it just, because they had, she and her roommate had such an interesting relationship. And now we're starting to see the roommate be like, "Is there something really up with Alexis? Like, it's been fun and games when I've been her BDSM party partner to go and record these sounds. But is there something else going on?" And that's where we really start to see a shift here. But I like that you also say that this is kind of the mark of her just going like full force villain of, "I could care, but I don't." Like, this is about me creating something, and nothing's going to get in the way of that.
Yes, because immediately after this, she goes after Duke because Duke saw her. And then Marie sees the blood coming from the RV and she's like, well, I gotta kill my best friend who I just kissed and we just had our moment. Like she's on a roll after this. Like this was literally her last boundary. It was her last step before she goes into whatever she's going to be.
Right. So, of course, one of the things to always underscore here is that at all of these killings, whether it's in private from the very beginning with the man that she had brought back to kind of like her recording place, all the way here, she's recording sound, and we're seeing kind of her kind of out of body experience almost of what this is like for her to hear this, to experience it, and then integrate it into music. And so, yes, she then goes after Winston. He gets lured back to, or tracks her down to kind of like this warehouse where she records or something. And she obviously kills him, records that. And then we get to Marie. They have a kiss. Again, I think there's a lot of underlying love and feeling
Yes.
there. Then Marie realizes, oh, we killed off this person. That's not great. Gotta do something about it. And this gets us to the very end of this movie. Oh my God, the ending of this film.
It's chaos. It goes full Jallo. It like literally it is her magnum opus. She's like, you all hear me. If I'm going to have to kill my bestie who was about to possibly be my person, you're gonna hear it. It also gives me big whatever happened to Baby Jane vibes. And again, I don't know if it's just because it's two women on the beach and there's chaos because one of them has done too much to the other or what, but it's what I think of.
Well, in watching it just for this record, you know what popped into my mind? Saint Maud.
Yes.
Because obviously her experience and the onlookers' experience are very different. So I don't know. There was something that very much echoed, like, again, wanting to make a statement, a piece here, and thinking that this is what you're communicating, and this is the vision and the feeling, but this is what people are seeing. So Marie. Walking on a beach, as one does, struggling a little bit. Struggling a little bit, a little bit hard walking, and we think maybe she had some tussle, but aren't we glad she made it? Boy, are we not glad. Because shit starts happening wicked fast. We get glimpses of Marie. Everything seems in place at first. Jesus fucking no. Speakers have been implanted and are sprouting from her body, like being ripped from her flesh, to play the music that Alexis has been recording. So she is like Alexis's fucking boombox on the beach. And this girl is being literally ripped apart by speakers playing the sound of her boy toy's death. It is a complete mind fuck. And it is stunning because you have Alexis who is just off in the way, almost like summoning her. Which really took me the fuck out because it's almost like she's like, yes, come to
She's
me.
conducting. I'm just
Yeah, she's a conductor. That's exactly what she's doing. It's a fucking maestro scene. Like,
Yeah.
take a seat, Bradley Cooper. This is what you need to be doing.
This is what he should have done. Yeah. I
Yeah, like,
would have watched the
it is.
movie.
Who needs to? Like, it's just like she's full out conducting.
Yeah.
And she, this is her masterpiece. And it is pinpointed by the fact that now you have the cries of her best friend, this person, like maybe her one. Because again, we never see Alexis with anyone. We don't see her in any kind of romantic entanglement outside of this kiss with
Yeah.
Marie. And so I get this feeling that maybe Marie is her one, and she's using Marie as kind of like her send off of like, this is my art. And the police show up because, again, you have at least someone who is able to say, well, let's track these things together and actually try to track someone down, follow some clues. That's a thing that we can do.
Yeah.
And so it's really sad because, the head police officer, I don't know if she's like a chief, is really kind of broken by this and is like, I feel really fucked up we didn't intervene and that we
Yes.
couldn't have stopped this. It is just brutal, like to see someone like literally kind of rip apart with speakers. It's almost like Cronenberg
Yes. Yes.
in a way, which I found very appealing. But then it just ends. The music stops. And Marie stops. And Alexis does not. She's like, well, that was cool. Thank you for listening. And come to my set next Saturday. And walks away. And it. What?
Because this ending is a graphic novel from hell, I would love to see her back again. And again, I'm not usually like, give it sequels, make it a franchise, but I just think that this character is so cool and so interesting, and she's the answer of so much shit that we are bombarded with, to where I will live in her world for another two movies at least. I will be like, who else do you need to kill? Let's do it. Go get it. I love this remix. I just think that I want to know more. I don't know if this detective gets therapy and heals and continues going after her, or if she's like, I'm off this case. I don't do this anymore. I'm now going to become a baker. I just want to know so much more about both of them now.
I often in my head, when I see that there's like a new show on Food Network, I try to like think about what their life was before. And they probably are like, I went to culinary school, something like that. And I'm like, no, you experienced some real shit. And the only way to deal with it was to pound fucking dough.
Listen,
And this is why you're here. And I would love that journey for her. So watch out, Food Network, now. Because this was released years ago, so she may have a baking show. Can't
yeah.
confirm.
I hope it's called What's in Your Oven.
Yeah. But yeah, I would love to see like what now? There's so one thing that I think we mentioned very briefly, but is obviously, when we talk about motivation, this is obviously like a key motivator, especially I think it happens right after National Anthem guy. We experience these moments with Alexis where every sound goes out. It is very silent. And she goes to a doctor. And we realize that her condition may be returning. Again, this is why we mentioned accident at the beginning, but if it was something that was perhaps corrected with surgery later on from an accident, is this something that would return? I don't know. So I don't know if this is maybe a progressive condition or whatever it is. The doctor very clearly states, this is something that could happen. We had talked about this, and we probably should have been doing some testing a little bit earlier, because yeah, your hearing can go again. And so I think that Alexis also is feeling kind of a race against a clock of I want to be able to create this piece before I'm not able to hear any longer. And so it's just very interesting. It would be a fascinating sequel to see if she had lost her hearing, but was still like, I'm still kind of chasing that experience. Like, what does that look like? Is there a collaborator that she brings in, that is kind of part of this? There's so many different opportunities, but I think in the interview with Alex, he said, my next film is something paranormal and dealing with like Nordic, folklore or something. So don't think that that's necessarily on the horizon, but I would love to see it.
I would really love to see it, especially if we respected the years apart between movies. And so, like, she's an older woman who I said like Jessica Soy Brown is in her 40s. I would like to see her being like a 30-something-year-old who has a hobby. And it's very dangerous and it's very risky. And she's still getting some reward from it, even if it's not 100% what it used to be for her.
What if she won a Grammy?
I would laugh. I hope she beats Taylor Swift. I'm not gonna lie.
Okay. See, don't, if you're listening to this podcast and you're stealing ideas, just credit us.
Yes.
Just say, it happened here. I love this idea. Because that's great. No, I agree. I think there's a lot of things to go into, but to circle back to a comment that you made also earlier, and I think this is such a great point. I'm a stickler for detail. I really love everything spelled out because I just love to be immersed in the detail and in the world and really have an understanding of how all the pieces of everything are fitting together. I do fine if I don't, but there's something that's very appealing to me to say, okay, I understand the rules and how this is functioning, and I understand how this is outside of the rules, or I understand how this is pushing up against something. And when you have fewer details, it's harder to construct those parameters. And so I like that we don't get a lot about her condition. We don't, it's just this one visit with the doctor that's like, hey, we should have been checking on this. This happens. And she, Alexis's reaction to this isn't necessarily one of, I want to burn it all down. It's kind of this, okay, well, this is now what my direction has to be.
Which is relatable because a lot of people who get a diagnosis are just like, well, this is how much time I have left with whatever the case may be. This is her last holiday. Like, could Queen Latifah be in the sequel?
Yeah. Wow. That would be a completely different film.
She was in, oh my God, The Bone Collector. And I always forget that because I saw it when I was a kid. And so she can give us a little bit of a thriller.
She can. I would be so interested in that. Wow. Now I'm going to be thinking about that a lot because that would be incredible. What if she played her mom?
Oh my God.
Think about it.
the relative who let the child go into foster care are taking them in because.
See, again, pay us for these ideas. They are plentiful. I do like the idea though, that we don't get all of the ins and outs, especially when we're dealing with disability. Obviously, I'm coming at it from a perspective of I want everything because I want to be able to say like, this is really cool. I appreciate X, Y, and Z. Or, hey, because you were dealing with this diagnosis, it seemed like you skipped this, and this. I can't do that. So congratulations, on that. But I do find it very interesting. And again, I'm always going to default. I'm not someone who is, deaf or hard of hearing. And so, you know, going back to the interview with Ariel and her saying like, especially these beginning scenes really resonate, I think is really profound. And something that's really important because again, it speaks to just the vast experience that folks have, in having a disability. I also, again, it would be very easy for me. And there was this inkling, I think the first time I watched it, to be like, is this falling into a disabled character villain trope of someone that has somehow been harmed or impacted, is quote unquote kind of this product of their disability and is wreaking havoc as a result. And I don't think that that's necessarily the case here, because we do have so much more complexity on what her motivations are. It isn't just related to her hearing and her synesthesia, which again, it's not really classified as a disability, more as an ability that folks have that doesn't really impact necessarily day to day. And again, that is associating like a color with a number or sensing, like having colors with sounds, those types of things. So I don't know, it's all really interesting. Really appreciated the interview with Alex and knowing the care that he put into it. And you know, I this film isn't talked about a lot, but I know, especially around its release, people were really talking about Jasmine's performance and how really interesting and fantastic and compelling it was. And so now here we are, you know, on the tail end of her doing this, Yellow Jackets, some Scream films. She's just kind of a, I think, a horror presence in the making, right before our eyes.
Love it. I love it. Like, she's so good in everything. I think she's doing a sci-fi something or other with Josh Rubin.
Yes.
And I literally just forgot the woman's name from Orphan Black. I've not been well today. And so I know her name.
Oh, it starts with a T. I know.
Tatiana Maslany. Thank you. Because
Yep.
I'm such a fan of
Thank
hers, but
you.
yeah, no, I'm gonna eat some crackers and like feel bad about that because like again, it's been a rough year and today was rough. And so a name just like completely went away and I see her face. I know her resume. Oh.
Yeah, and She-Hulk. She was just in
Yes.
She-Hulk. So
Yeah.
yeah, she is. No, I'm really excited because I think, you know, Jasmine, I think, is in a really interesting place in her career where the world is really her oyster in terms of how whatever direction she wants to go. And so it will be interesting to see the projects that she levitates towards now. You know, it has been really great. She has been such a highlight for me in Scream 5 and 6. Like,
One of my favorite
I know that
characters.
people kind of have mocked, I think, her character a little bit, but when we talk about a perfect fusion of the Randy and Kirby characters, she is top of the tier. Like, You're not going to get any better than I think a purity that she brings to just the joy of being Mindy and knowing her shit
Yes.
about film.
I also love it because Kirby, back, was it 2011 when Scream 4 came out? They were not going to let anybody in that movie be explicitly queer and not be the butt of a joke. But like, we've all assumed for Kirby. And so I love that, like, here comes Mindy and she's like, guess what? So again, it's the perfect fusion of all the things we saw and all the things we saw. I also love that Jasmine's already starting to produce things because that's how we're going to get more quality stuff.
Exactly. I love it. So yeah. I don't know if you have anything else to say about The Sound of Violence, but this movie is it is one to experience. I really, really like it. And one thing I will say, if you are watching or you're listening to this and maybe you've just done kind of a periphery watch of the film, go back and rewatch. There are some Easter eggs for you to unpack because this was also like a substantial part of the conversation that Alex had with Ariel. And I remember watching it the first time and being like, is that what I think it is? Because I never want to think that I'm actually like recognizing something because I'm not that smart. People will say, oh, well, this was a reference to these five films. And I'll be like, what? They're like, haven't you seen those? And I'm like, yep. You're telling me that's a reference? They're like, yep. I'm like, wow, completely missed. So there are some Easter eggs. So be on the lookout for those because I think that's always just kind of a fun thing. But he's a very interesting director, really, really passionate about art. Again, I think the film that he talked about in this interview has been a little while back, was about doing something paranormal, Nordic based. So not really going in on that artist perspective. I like it. It is on streaming. It's, I think, on Showtime.
And Paramount.
So if you are one of those people like me who just signs over their paycheck to every streaming service that they can have access to, there you go. But definitely give this a watch. I think it's something that a lot of people haven't seen. And I think it's really worth a discussion.
Yes, I love this movie so much. I'm so happy we talked about it. Thank you again for having me.
All right, so now we get to the fun part of the episode. And this is what I like to call the plugs. So, Cherie, you have been so kind to spend your time here talking about this amazing movie. I know that we talked off at the very front about all the places that you are, but tell us about where you are and what you have coming up.
The easiest way to get into everything I'm doing is to find me on Twitter or Instagram at Miss Sheree. There are three S's in there. It seemed smart at the time, and now we're all here. And from there, you can find me talking very loudly about my podcast, A Nightmare on Fear Street, and my other podcast, Birdie Massacre. I am a soccer mom for both. I'm just like, look what we've done. This is my baby. And people like to put an episode every week. And I'm like, shh. And I am also writing for Dread Central and Horror Movie Blog, which is run by A Nightmare on Fifth Street, which is an accidental sister podcast because people started podcasts in the pandemic and we found each other and it's been amazing. I also, at the time of recording this, put up my first article on Nyx, which is a new outlet you should be all reading because it's giving people of color a chance to talk about horror in a safe place. And it's new. And so you have to embrace it while it's new because every once in a while things blow up and they don't get to be as cool and indie anymore. And so you got to get in while it's good before they have to be like, well, we
Yeah.
have a sponsor. The sponsors. But yes, I also write for Horror Press LLC. I'm their Shudder streaming guide girl. And sometimes I get to have a rant or two, depending on what's going on.
I will say, like, following your writing, I know on Dread Central and other places, like, if there's one person that if you want a recommendation of a film, there's going to be few people who are going to present you with a list and some facts and break it down for you the way that Sheree does. It is a phenomenal thing to experience because sometimes just in my head, I'll be like, wow, I wonder about, like, I would like to watch a film like this. And then I will get on the socials and you will be like, hello, I have just curated a list of films about this. And these are probably films that you may not be familiar with, and you should watch them, and here's where they are, and they are great. I'm like, God damn it, it's so good. So yes. Nightmare on Fear Street is so good. It is an amazing podcast. I love Bloody Massacre. You are out there doing some really amazing work, with some really amazing folks. So, really, really thrilled to have you here. And of course, happy to hear you more on the Anatomy of a Scream Pod Squad as well.
Yes, I love it over on this network. Every time I get to do an Alter Tapes, because that's another podcast, the Alter Tapes. We have fun over there. I remember when Joe originally was like, do we all want to do this? We're like, we're already watching the Alter Shorts. Why not? And
Yeah.
it's been fun growing the family. And it's very low key. And so it's like, ooh, we get to like have lunch and talk about a movie. Okay. And then you go back to like your life, but it's a nice little. It's a nice little pause. It's a nice little, let's talk about a filmmaker we want to see make a feature or a movie that should be a feature. Because
Exactly.
that's where all of us are because we don't get greenlit for movies and TV shows. So a lot of us are directing shorts.
Exactly. No, it's a lot of fun. And I never really talk about it, which again, I know I say this, I've been saying this for, I don't know, a long time. It's like I should probably do better about being like, hey, I have also been over here and talking about this blah blah blah, blah. I've been on Alter Tapes. I've talked about shorts. I've talked about shorts with you.
Yes.
So yes, the Alter Tapes, shorts are so fun because I think they really do get your mind going in a different way. It really challenges you to think about what the director is trying to say and, how would you make this into a feature? Is this story really worthy? Does it have kind of that length to it, that kind of element to it that would make sense for it to be a feature? It's really good stuff. So definitely check out the Alter Tapes, and yes, you can hear Sheree dropping some knowledge over there. If you want to reach out to me, you can. You know the drill. You can find me on Twitter, Twixt, X, whatever we're calling it these days. We're just not calling it calm. I can be found there at Bodies Whore. And of course, I'm also on Instagram, which has become one of my favorite places to actually be about the place. I just find it very, very comforting, and it is good. And you can find me over there at Bodies of Horror Podcast. And I believe it is the same over at Blue Sky. So check me out. You can also reach me at bodiesofhorror@gmail.com. I've gotten a few emails from folks responding to different episodes and sharing suggestions for films, which always just makes me absolutely delighted. So thank you for that. And with that, thank you again, Sheree. Please know that you have a complete open door invitation. Anytime you want to come by, please know you are welcome here
I'll
to
see you soon.
chat about, yes, to chat about anything, because this has been ridiculously fun. So thank you all for listening. Thank you to Anatomy of the Scream Pod Squad for being the heart and the home of Bodies of Horror, and With all of that said, until next time.
Anatomy of a Scream, Pod Squad.